First case is People versus State of Colorado versus Jason LaRosa. Are both parties ready?
People ready, Your Honor.
Thank you. Couple housekeeping matters for the both lawyers as well as the audience. First, argument is set for a half hour per side, and Mr. Kohler, you'll have to keep track of your time. Please state your name as you start your argument. But I wanted to mention that some of us have iPads, which we use to prepare for argument and have all the briefs on it, our notes, and can link to Westlaw Next. So I want you to be aware that some of us will be using them, and it's not that we're surfing or not paying attention to the arguments. So with that, please proceed.
May I please the court and counsel, Paul Kaler, 19210 for the people in this case. This is the corpus delicti case, and I'd like to present my roadmap of what I'd like to say this morning. Corpus delicti rule obviously provides that in a case where a defendant's conviction is based on his confession, that the proof of the bad act must be proved by evidence coming from outside of that confession. Our argument today is that it should no longer be followed in Colorado for two reasons. First of all, the corpus delicti rule is flawed from the outset, because it only looks at whether someone committed the crime at issue and not whether the defendant committed the crime and whether his confession is reliable and should be given to the jury. As far as that, we think that the trustworthy doctrine that the U.S. Supreme Court began following in the 1950s provides a better means of addressing that question. Is the defendant's confession something worthy of consideration by the jury? Secondly, since I said it, the rule that better does it was being followed by the Supreme Court in the 1950s, the question is, has anything that happened in the legal world since the 1950s made that rule itself out of date? Some courts, almost all courts that have rejected the pure corpus delicti rule that Colorado follows right now, have looked at these developments in the law since then as reasons for reinforcing the following of the trustworthiness doctrine. Two courts, though, Brown from the Sixth Circuit and Dickerson from the D.C. Court of Appeals, have suggested, and although obviously they're both federal courts and they're bound by Opper and Smith themselves, have posited that these developments have rendered the trustworthiness approach, the more modern approach, itself out of date. That's my argument here, is that the developments in the law have rendered things out of date so that the concerns behind the corpus delicti doctrine are better met by other means available to courts and defendants and prosecutors, and that what courts should now be following concerning confession-based evidence is our old familiar substantial evidence test. Corpus delicti doctrine obviously is pretty old, dates to the 17th century. It's supposed to be based on a couple of cases where people were convicted and then executed for murders, and then the murder victims showed up sometime somewhat later. Back then, the fear supporting the corpus delicti doctrine was fear of improper means used to produce confessions. The stress of being the focus of an investigation could cause somebody to confess falsely. And also, the real fear, and people are not denying that at all, that there are some people crazy running around, and they could possibly confess to crimes they did not commit. All those three are valid reasons supporting the corpus delicti rule. But at least in this country, corpus delicti doctrine has been under attack for at least 100 years. And I think there are several good reasons for doing so. First of all, there's nothing wrong with a valid confession. A valid confession is a perfectly acceptable form of proof. And the corpus delicti rule, the effect of the corpus delicti rule is to treat all confessions, the possibility that a confession is not correct or invalid, they change that possibility into a presumption of unreliability. So the one of the criticisms is that it does not grant strong likelihood or makes the possibility the presumption of invalidity. Confessions can be made for good reasons. I think we have two of them here. First of all, the defendant confessed to, or he made a statement to his pastor. Confessing one's sins is a perfectly valid motivation for speaking about a crime. Secondly, he said he was worried about the effect his crime had on his daughter, and he didn't want her to suffer from it as he grew up. Again, that is another valid reason for confessing to a crime. I think the rules of evidence also support that. There's nothing wrong with confessions. Under 801 D2, admissions by a party opponent, that just comes in. There's no necessity of any sort of reliability determination in that. If it's made by a party opponent, it comes into evidence.
Could I ask you a question? I've been a little confused about some of the old doctrine, and especially where you're going here. Is the corpus delicti doctrine a doctrine, an evidentiary doctrine at all about admissibility?
Well, I've read a bunch. There's cases going everywhere. Some courts say it's a pretrial admissibility question. Some courts say it's a sufficiency question. Some other courts say it's a matter for instructing the jury on. I think the way Colorado has addressed it, and I think the two main Colorado cases that aren't completely ancient are Downey and Meredith. One was a sexual assault on child case like this one. The other one was a homicide case. But they treated both as admissibility question and as a sufficiency question. Another big criticism of the corpus delicti rule, as I previously mentioned, is it does not protect the defendant from confessing to a crime committed by someone else. Corpus delicti, again, as followed by Colorado and Meredith and Downey, looks at whether the crime occurred. It does not require tying the defendant to the crime with outside evidence. That's the problem, because it doesn't. That's a problem. Secondly, the scope of the rule is too great, because it protects defendants who target victims either because of their age or because of some sort of infirmity will not be able to confirm what was done to them. And it could also allows defendants to commit crimes where there's no tangible injury left. Again, both of those factors are present in this case.
Wait, could I just ask you a question? With respect to the corpus delicti and the trustworthiness test that you think we shouldn't adopt, both of those allow the judge to be something of a gatekeeper, or in many states that would be the case. Is
yes,
that right?
It's a substantial gatekeeping role to the
right.
evidence, Your Honor.
Either at the close of the prosecution evidence or pretrial.
Pretrial or at the end or even on appeal. Again, the cases are all over the place.
Sure. The rule that you're proposing, substantial evidence, is just simply the regular rule we have. If there's enough evidence to go to the jury, and there would be, therefore, very little, if any, real gatekeeping function on the part of the judge, any more than judge would normally have at the close of evidence.
Right. Gatekeeping as far as all the Fourth and Fifth Amendment protections. Obviously, right. Confession has to be taken in the proper manner. There are obviously problems with in this case, the defendant did not have a daughter, or there was no such place as Highlands Ranch, or the daughter was a different age, or that there was no rec center in Highlands Ranch. Obviously, that would give rise to a claim, possibly a pretty strong claim, that the evidence was meets the incredible as a matter of law standard, because the crime could not have physically happened.
I guess my question is this: given that there were pretty good policy reasons in the, historically at least, for having a gatekeeping role or assigning a gatekeeping role to the court, when there's only a confession, there may be some indicia of the truthfulness of that confession, but there is only a confession. Why should we abandon that?
Again, because it does not protect against the defendant confessing to a crime that somebody else committed. And again, also, the scope is too broad. It gives greater protections to guilty defendants that are justified by the situation. As part of law over the last few decades,
I'm interrupting you because I wanted to follow up on that particular thing. I mean, it's almost a distinction without a difference in my mind, or maybe it's just a distinction with a different emphasis, since the judge in any event has a gatekeeping role even under your substantial evidence test. And I'm just thinking, what it's almost semantic, really. We would say be saying what, the under substantial evidence, the judge wouldn't take a look at this evidence early or midpoint in the trial, but only whether or not there's enough evidence to go to the jury. I mean, how is it really, what you're proposing, really different?
Well, it does not operate on presumption that the confession is itself invalid. And I think that's one of the big problems with the corpus delicti rule, is that all confessions are presumed unreliable from the very get-go, unless there is evidence showing that the crime in question actually occurred. Our proposed rule is that confession should be treated like any other evidence. There's nothing, it's wrong to presume them unreliable from the very beginning. They can be shown to be unreliable, either through pretrial suppression process. It can be shown by evidence that convinces the jury that it was made by somebody who's mentally deranged and therefore is not reliable. The question is, we think that there's no reason to categorically bar all confessions without this outside proof from being considered by the jury, and that's currently what the corpus delicti rule does.
So, right there. I guess I'm struggling a little bit with where your line of argument that the presumption is that these confessions are unreliable. How so?
That they cannot be considered by the jury unless they are supported by proof outside of the confession that someone committed the crime in question.
I guess I'm not understanding why that means that they're inherently unreliable. It's simply that the prosecution needs to show more than simply the confession, something that corroborates that confession. So
I see that point a little bit beyond that. Unless the evidence can be shown, there's no way for the jury to consider the validity of that testimonial. It's just like under the old corroboration requirement for in rape cases that Colorado followed up until about 100 years ago. An alleged rape victim could not testify, and her testimony could not be used to support a conviction in a sexual assault case unless it was corroborated by outside sources. Our point is that a confession may be invalid, but it can be shown through some way, through evidence, and not through sort of this presumption that it must be proved by outside evidence, the target of the crime must be proved by outside evidence before it can even be considered by the jury.
And I guess what I'm struggling with is, my understanding anyway, is that the reason they can't go to a jury in that context is not because the confession is inherently or presumptively unreliable, but simply because it is so powerful. And standing alone, a jury isn't inclined to go ahead and believe that. And so we're putting the prosecution through its paces by requiring the prosecution, as we do in every case, to prove all the elements of the offense charge. And absent them, I can think of myriad other circumstances where a prosecution might be unable to meet those elements for whatever reason. And yes, I can imagine situations where, an otherwise guilty defendant may escape justice in that context. How is this really any different?
The confession can be shown or to be invalid through the normal processes. First, the question concerning was the confession derived through some sort of official misconduct, through coercion, involuntariness, lack of counsel, something like that. That can be shown through a suppression hearing where it's based on evidence that is before the judge. The judge can make a reasoned determination that there's nothing improper with the confession in the way it was procured. That
all right, so that goes to the coercion piece or the potential for coercion, and you've also alluded to mental illness that might give rise to that. Well, if someone simply gives a false confession, maybe they are perfectly sane and they want to take the rap for someone else, but for whatever reason there is no corpus delicti that the prosecution can prove. I mean, I guess I'm just thinking that there are other circumstances outside of coercion, outside of mental illness, where you might have a false confession, and this would protect such defendants.
Sure, but that's a matter that can be presented to the jury and litigated. There's all sorts of types of evidence that can come before a jury that have some questionable value. We know about there's problems with eyewitness identification stuff. Heat of the moment, gun sticking in your face, somebody you've never seen before sticking the gun in your face. There can be problems with a person correctly identifying the person who robbed them or did whatever to them. But that is a question that can be presented to a jury and argued to the jury, and a jury which is entrusted with finding facts in the case can make a reasoned decision based on evidence, based on the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. We're not saying, I think the problem with corpus delicti is that it stops any sort of proof on this type of area. We say, let the jury decide it based on evidence, based on the civil rules, based on and the trial court's gatekeeping function in Fourth and Fifth Amendment matters. We think that it should just go to the jury or go to the trial court first, suppression issues, and then there's nothing wrong with presenting a valid or presumptively valid confession, but then the defendant can come forward and say, I did this for some improper reason. I was crazy, or I did it. I said it as a joke, or something like that. That is a question that juries are capable of addressing on their own, and that's why we think that this type of case should be resolved.
Can I go back to Justice Rice's question?
Sure, Your Honor.
On this issue of trustworthiness, let's assume there's only a confession. Maybe this is an example case of it. Does the judge, in making this determination about whether that should go to the jury, is there some evidentiary burden on the prosecution to prove the trustworthiness of it? Or would you simply leave it to the suppression mechanism?
I guess it could happen at different times. I think in this case we had pre-trial, mid-trial, post-trial, and then appellate raisings of the claim. I guess it could be raised in many different ways. Under the U.S. Supreme Court's version and the operant stuff, the question is whether substantial evidence supports the trustworthiness of the confession. It can be based either on the manner of the giving of the confession, either the way the defendant tells it, like we think in this case, or also in the way that the police took the confession from a person. Again, like in this case, there's absolutely no claim of any sort of official oppression involved in taking the confession.
Substantial evidence is different from, say, preponderance of the evidence or some higher test. It seems to me that substantial evidence, you're talking about the Bennett case? That line of cases, or what? What are you referring to?
Bennett is our standard case for substantial evidence test. Under Smith and Opera, there's a number of courts that have addressed their sort of gatekeeping function is theirs, whether they're, like this case from 11th Circuit called Falada, independent evidence must fortify, strengthen, or add weight to the credibility of the confession. Reddish, which is a New Jersey Supreme Court case, any legal evidence that tends to generate a belief in the statement's trustworthiness. It should, as any sort of gatekeeping function, it should be a fairly a lower standard, because that allows the jury who is charged with deciding the facts in a criminal case to decide the actual factual claims being made in the case, and not to prevent from the very beginning that inquiry going forward.
Could I follow up on that question by Justice Hobson? So when you talk about trustworthiness, I'm having a little trouble telling whether you're talking about admissibility or you're talking about sufficiency.
Oftentimes it's done in a pretrial situation or prior to the admission of the evidence.
Well, and that with regard to the admissibility of the evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
So that has nothing to do with Bennett then, right?
No, Your Honor, that's why I'm saying.
And what would be the basis under the rules of evidence then for making a determination about admissibility? Is this a question of, like, relevance? Are we saying this is so unreliable it's not relevant, or what?
Well, that's one of our questions, Your Honor. That's one of our points, Your Honor, is under 801D2, an admission by a party opponent comes in as is.
Okay, so it's not a hearsay problem, not an out-of-court statement problem, you're saying?
If you look at the Utah Supreme Court case, which is Motchley, they try to thread that needle a little bit. They say it's something like pretrial suppression hearings. But I think the problem with that view is that pretrial suppression hearings are based on violations of constitutional law, where you go forward on evidence and not on sort of this generalized belief that they're unreliable.
And narrow you down just a little, because we're talking so broadly here. Does this case have anything to do with admissibility, or is it purely a question of whether this case should have gone to the jury on our Bennett substantial evidence?
I guess it comes, well, I won't help you out on this, Your Honor. I'll say I think it was raised both ways. I think the way we fought over it in the Court of Appeals was it was as a straight sufficiency of the evidence question, wherein the corpus delicti rule played a role in determining whether the evidence was sufficient.
And am I wrong? It seemed on the face of it that's the way the Court of Appeals decided it. Is that how you recall?
Yes, Your Honor. That's how I believe it was.
Can I ask one follow-up on that because of your timing? You guys cover so much history and do so much different jurisdictions. So in this jurisdiction, are you aware of this court deciding anything since Bennett that would say that a confession was insufficient evidence? And if so, do you know what the nature of those cases were?
No, Your Honor. I don't know of any case like that.
Okay.
Counsel, before you move on, just to follow up, just to pin you down one more time, do you, on the Court of Appeals opinion, do you concede that they got it right if our doctrine remains unchanged?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. So there has to be a change in doctrine.
Has to be a change in doctrine. Under the corpus delicti doctrine, as is, as in Meredith and the other case, which Downey, there's the evidence insufficient under the unchanged traditional corpus delicti doctrine.
But you do think they got it right in phrasing it as a sufficiency question?
Yes, yes. A lot of courts address it that way. And
you keep saying that. A lot of courts do that. What do you want us to do?
I would say I would address it as a sufficiency claim. Okay. That's a perfect, we deal with that all the time. Appellate courts deal with that all the time. Trial judges deal with it, mid-trial motions for judgment of acquittal. It's something we all deal with and know how to address. The standards are so clear that it's an easy rule to apply.
Thank you.
Let's play ping pong here and come back to this side. In a second. All right, then. Your answer to Justice Ide's question suggests then that you feel Bennett did not change the law with regard to Downey or Meredith or any pre-Bennett cases we had decided. Is that right? I mean, you say the Court of Appeals was clearly right and we'd have to overturn this doctrine.
Maybe I wasn't clear about that. Bennett is one of the cases, one of the post-mid-1950s changes in the law that we think is significant. Under Bennett, if the evidence goes forward like this, if it's not incredible as a matter of law, then it's proper for the jury to consider in making its determination, and it's proper for an appellate court or a reviewing court to factor in into its sufficiency evidence claim.
So does Bennett or any of the post-Bennett cases, or do any of those cases suggest an exception or limitation on our light most favorable to the prosecution rule?
Except a confession? No, there's nothing like that, Your Honor.
And I assume you would also put in that scale of going for a change in the common law, all the laws surrounding coerced confessions and Miranda advisements and all that.
Some courts say that the basis of the corpus delicti rule is flawed just because it does not tie the defendant to the crime. A crazy defendant, could theoretically confess to a crime committed by someone else. So
So more scrutiny is needed than just the availability of the suppression mechanism.
And arguments since the 50s, up until the 50s, the Supreme Court's approach and operant Smith, it provides a better means of addressing it because it looks at the validity of the defendant's confession itself, either by through the means of his giving his confession or supporting evidence from outside. And I think under the operant Smith trustworthiness approach, I think the evidence here is sufficient to support the conviction. But I'm not just staying right there. I'm saying that that approach is out of date as well in light of the substantial evidence test and everything that occurred in the 60s and 70s and even recently concerning giving juries the authority to make contested fact determinations. You know, like, well, for instance, you know, Apprendi, Blakely, Ring versus Arizona, when making fact findings concerning sentencing determinations, presumptions concerning the ability of jurors to understand and follow jury instructions. I think a lot has happened since the 50s, and maybe I can say a lot has happened since the 17th century that allows jurors to make reasoned factual determinations concerning these kind of issues. And the proper place for this determination is not by a trial judge or an appellate judge, except during the substantial evidence test, but by the jury at trial, by the parties presenting evidence concerning these issues.
Ms. Kaler, I guess I want to make sure I understand. The difference between trustworthiness and substantial evidence is essentially the gatekeeping function. Is that fair to say? Okay. Justice Coates mentioned this isn't hearsay, but trial judges regularly on hearsay perform the trustworthiness residual hearsay exception, which I'm sure you're familiar with. So that's also a development in at least in evidence admissibility. So what is the actual policy reason that you have for eliminating the gatekeeping function of the trial court with respect to this rule?
Well, it comes in under a declaration by a party opponent, and that just comes in. There's no sort of reliability.
Well, that's in a civil case, and this is a criminal case. And in fact, well, you've read them, I'm sure. There are cases of truly false confessions. Hopefully they're rare. But in any event, or even just confessions that are hard to believe. So what's the policy reason? I don't. You argue about sentencing, you know, Sixth Amendment rights and so forth, and thinking about the jury. But it seems to me that gatekeeping function is a legitimate remnant of the role of a trial judge in lots of areas, and certainly that's a major shift from the corpus delicti rule dealing with confessions.
Well, courts obviously do gatekeeping concerning part of the rationale behind the corpus delicti rule through suppression hearings, and that's a huge part of that. As far as gatekeeping function concerning whether the defendant is crazy,
not crazy. That's not the point. It's whether it's trustworthy.
Yeah, well, under the Opper Smithing, they do make a determination that it's trustworthy. The manner of giving it or the facts revealed by the confession make a showing that the confession is trustworthy and can be relied upon and presented to the jury. I'll reserve the rest of my time unless anybody has a question right now. Thank you, Your Honors.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, Forrest Lewis on behalf of Mr. LaRosa. From Mr. LaRosa's standpoint, it is true that the Attorney General has conceded in their briefs that under Rankin and Colorado law regarding corpus delicti, the Court of Appeals decision was correct, and that under the existing rule, there was insufficient evidence as a matter of law. So from Mr. LaRosa's standpoint, the policy argument is not really dispositive as to him. I suppose we could talk about Rogers, but it's not dispositive as to him in terms of the Court of Appeals ruling. I do believe that the cases suggest that the corpus delicti rule evolved and exists not as an evidentiary rule, not as an admissibility issue, but as a substantive rule which relates to the legal sufficiency of the evidence. I also think that a Bennett analysis and the proposal for allowing all of these cases to come under Bennett is not helpful. The reason for that is that Bennett relates to the elements of the offenses and whether or not there's legally sufficient evidence. We might well have a confession in a case, and do, which satisfies all the elements of the offenses, which would satisfy a narrow reading of the Bennett test, but would not satisfy the purpose and the reason for corpus delicti. I do believe that it's far from an evidentiary admissibility issue. I agree with what Judge Nieto said in Robson, where he said this is a substantive rule of law.
But it's a hybrid
substantive rule of law, because it's not an element, and yet it's part of the sufficiency of evidence analysis that the courts need to make and do make as a gatekeeping function. And it does serve a valid, legitimate purpose. So it's a sufficiency of the evidence. Hybrid, but
to
certainly
us,
more substantive.
What is the purpose, specifically, as you see it?
The purpose of the corpus selectum?
Yes.
I believe these facts to be self-evident. We see a lot of confessions in these cases. We see confessions which satisfy all the elements of the offense. We see confessions.
Are you talking about the sexual assault on the child context or other contexts?
I'm talking about any context, but today we're talking about sexual assault on a child. These confessions are admissible under evidentiary standards. They would pass the test under Miranda. They would pass the test of voluntariness, but they are not reliable. And
what is the basis for saying that? I mean, you'd think they'd be totally reliable, and that the policy of the law would be that you should prosecute such a case, especially a case like this, when there aren't any other witnesses and maybe no other evidence.
And that's just what juries think. And
yeah.
The California court talked about in Jones, and that's the reason for the corpus selecti rule, because that's the reasoning that jurors employ. If he or she said it and they confess to it, they did it. But that's not always true. It's not always true. And so the corpus delicti rule guards against, with judicial gatekeeping role, those cases in which we acknowledge that confessions are probably...
Have you got any empirical evidence for that people confess to crimes like this that they didn't commit? I mean, what are you relying on just to...
I don't think that... I'm not aware of any empirical studies. I don't know if studies have been done or not. But I know the corpus delicti rule itself, I suppose, is some evidence that that happens. We have confessions in cases where there isn't any independent evidence that a crime has ever been committed. So I suppose the corpus delicti rule in and of itself is proof of those cases where we have a confession, but really nothing to support it. It might be admissible. It is extremely powerful to a jury. It's the most powerful type of evidence that we have to a jury. But there's no evidence that a crime had been committed.
So, Lewis, the question that I've been struggling with is that the court, of course, has a gatekeeping role, even under the substantial evidence test. And so how does one really verbalize or write the difference? Is it a presumption, as Mr. Culler would suggest, which I don't think is necessarily the way all the courts have analyzed it, a presumption that the confession is bad, that someone has to overcome in order to make it admissible? I don't think that's the way the courts have gone. What would be the difference in what a trial judge would actually do when confronted with a motion to dismiss, you know, pretrial for lack of substantial evidence?
Yeah, I do not believe that the cases suggest there's a presumption of unreliability or inadmissibility.
So absent a presumption, which...
I don't think there is.
So what is the difference?
I think the statements are evaluated under the rules regarding statements, under evidentiary rules.
Sure.
I think that the gatekeeping role for the court is to be sure under the corpus delicti rule that there is some evidence, however slight.
So you think there is a standard. There has to be something more, and rather than just whether the statement itself is inherently trustworthy or there is, quote, substantial evidence to support it. I mean, I know we get very mixed up in semantics, and that's why I'm trying to kind of to drill down a little bit. So under corpus delicti, the trial judge would be confronted with this question. We have a confession. Is there anything more, a scintilla of something more, which would suggest that this confession is valid or good or trustworthy or relevant or reliable or anywhere that we wanted to choose?
And that's what our cases have held. You know, Rankin probably didn't.
And if we didn't have the corpus delicti rule, the judge would say, I have this confession, looking at it and nothing else, since I'm no longer required to find something more, I have to decide whether this is reliable. I mean, see, that's my problem, so help me.
If we didn't have the corpus delicti rule, you would have to decide which way to go. If it's purely sufficiency of the evidence, the trial court wouldn't decide anything.
But isn't sufficiency of the evidence the same as something more? And well, tell me what the difference is then, please.
Sufficiency of the evidence is an elemental issue, and corpus delicti is something.
We'll play that out. Tell me what that would sound like.
You could say, the court could say, we're going to go on a straight sufficiency of the evidence that would totally abandon corpus delicti and the requirement of independent evidence that a crime had actually been committed. So if a defendant confessed and the confession satisfied all the elements, you're done.
You're saying that in and of itself is sufficient.
Right. Yeah, that's a bad idea. That's just a really bad idea.
So you don't think sufficiency implies something more than just simply meeting the elements?
No, and that's a problem. The other thing you could do is go to some middle ground, which isn't really a middle ground, on the corroboration rule or the trustworthiness rule, and look for, again, we're back to independent evidence of the trustworthiness of the statement. We're going back to independent evidence anyway. If you look at the corroboration and trustworthiness cases, and I'm sure you have.
What about the fact that it's this confession is done multiple times, right? It wasn't just a single confession. I mean, he was making a point of saying, you know, I'm guilty of this, and this just isn't right, and don't you want to promote that? I mean, you do that in a guilty plea context, different context, right? This is preserving the right to a jury trial, but...
It shouldn't be surprising to us that if a defendant makes a statement which is untrue or unreliable, which is the result of mental illness or some other motivation, it shouldn't surprise us that that defendant would repeat the statement. He or she may repeat it several times. That goes to the underlying reason for making the statement, which is invalid in the first place. Certainly people who are mentally disturbed might make multiple statements. The Court of Appeals pointed out in a footnote, as you know, in their opinion, that in the TAO case, the Court of Appeals case, there were two confessions there. The Court of Appeals discussed some literature. I mean, it's a very interesting point, and they discussed some literature on that. But as a practical matter, on the street, if someone is going to be mentally disturbed enough or confused enough or improperly motivated enough to make a statement about a crime that didn't happen, it shouldn't surprise us that they repeat it many times. So I just don't see that. I see it as
yeah, but you said a lot of if-ifs there, and I'm assuming the defense counsel, you know, whatever the client says, is going to have to bring forward evidence and questioning that, in fact, this person is disturbed. I don't know whether it's incompetence. Obviously, that's not what you're talking about, but... for some reason, said it in the first place and repeated it. I mean, which, isn't that a matter of defense?
Which brings us to another problem. The Attorney General in our case seems to be suggesting that some burden be put on a defendant in a case where there is a statement made, and certainly a defendant might want to get up and talk about his or her statement. But the suggestion almost is that there's some sort of burden shifting in these cases where there isn't a corpus delicti. The defendant needs to prove he was mentally ill or the statement was product of some other improper motive. That would be a big change in the law to shift that burden of proof to the defendant in a criminal case. That would really be a policy change.
Can I take you back to sufficiency a little and pick up on Justice Rice's line of questioning just a little bit? And maybe I should summarize what I think you have said, and you could correct me. But with regard to admissibility, it sounds to me like you're very definitively saying this is, you're not making an argument at all that this is evidence that should be kept away from a jury. It's admissible. Then the question seems to be, is it sufficient, though? Is it enough evidence for the jury to decide this rather than a court? And if I'm understanding your argument, you're saying there is something unique about this kind of evidence that it should be kept away, that the court should have to decide this rather than a jury. A jury will not make a good determination based on this kind of confession alone. They're dangerous, so we need to keep it away from them. But my guess where I'm coming down is, and maybe it's where Justice Rice was going, where the tension between these two, how we decide a case, what's the basis for deciding where does a corpus delicti rule fit in? At least since 1973, when we did Bennett, we sort of leaped into the modern world, got rid of our old circumstantial versus direct evidence, no longer have to disprove alternate hypotheses. I think I hear you saying that if we simply follow what we said in Bennett about sufficient evidence to reach the jury, this kind of case would reach the jury. So are you saying we implicitly allowed an exception to the Bennett rule, or we should now allow an exception to the Bennett rule? How does corpus delicti fit into the model of sufficiency and admissibility of evidence that we have?
It doesn't, because it's not a statutory element of the offense. We don't have a jury instruction on it. The judicial branch can't make it an element of the offense, so it's a judicial rule. It's a judicial rule created to be applied by trial judges, by the judiciary. I don't think that Bennett does anything for corpus delicti. I don't think that they're related. I think that that's a judicial rule which must be applied in the trial court's gatekeeping role at some point in time. Unless we want to come up with a jury instruction, I suppose we could come up with a jury instruction explaining corpus delicti to a jury, okay? If we had that sort of jury instruction, the court could hold that if that instruction is given and the jury makes that determination, that we've satisfied both corpus delicti and Bennett. But what burden of proof do you put? I mean, as the law now exists, the cases on corpus delicti, Quinn and other cases, require some evidence, but not proof beyond a reasonable doubt. How would we deal with that procedure?
Let me follow up with that just briefly. With regard to things that have been decided then since Bennett, or were decided before, is it not reasonable? In Bennett, we set down the rule for, in this jurisdiction, how we would determine if there is enough evidence to reach the jury, or when the case should be taken away from the jury and decided by the judge. If we did not make any exception for the corpus delicti rule, was it not overruled to the extent that it existed before at the time we decided Bennett?
I go back to our earlier discussion and draw the distinction between elements of the offense and the corpus delicti rule, which is a separate gatekeeper.
And that means you're saying Bennett was not a rule that fully decided when there's enough evidence to reach a jury.
I will say, I think the real point is, I do not believe Bennett affected the corpus delicti rule, its viability, or the way it's applied. I don't think Bennett intended to do that. I don't think that it proposed to do that. I don't think it affected corpus delicti at all.
It's not a constitutionally compelled rule, corpus delicti. It's kind of common law rule, you know, invented 3 centuries ago, right?
I think that's conceded.
Having to do with control of the jury process.
I think that's conceded by everyone.
Okay.
The ironic thing, Justice Rice, we were talking earlier about how do you apply this trustworthiness or corroboration rule. The ironic thing to me is when you read the cases and you really get down into the facts of the cases, what the courts are finding as independent evidence of trustworthiness, for the most part, is corpus delicti by another name. They're truly getting into the fact that there's independent evidence that a crime was committed, and that's what makes the statement trustworthy.
Well, it does seem to me that corpus delicti and trustworthiness are probably the same thing by another name. But substantial evidence is different, I guess, and that's the position you're taking.
Well, I think substantial evidence is a totally different concept.
And the reason substantial evidence is really different is that it just is there enough to go to the jury and nothing more? There's no greater burden on the judge when analyzing the evidence.
Right.
In both trustworthiness and corpus delicti require something more.
And it's still independent evidence. They still talk about independent evidence, evidence independent of the confession. So we're still talking about independent evidence. I just don't see how it would be manageable for the court to bring corpus delicti into the Bennett rule and the substantial evidence rule. We don't have that as an element in the statute. We don't have jury instructions. We have burden of proof issues. The court would have to change a lot of law on a lot of different grounds to really make that viable. If you went to...
So it's, you know, either we keep it or we throw it out entirely. I mean, that's the choice, right? That's what you just painted.
No, I don't think so. I think that the trustworthiness corroboration rule, whatever that is, some courts and some commentators see that as a middle ground. What I'm saying is, if you really look at the cases, what they're really doing in the trustworthiness analysis is finding independent evidence to support the confession. So why not keep corpus lecti?
Isn't the trustworthiness, though, when I think about it, the kind of independent evidence they're finding goes to the trustworthiness of the confession, as opposed to corpus lecti really goes to whether or not there was this crime. Is the way I've always kind of thought about the difference. We can't find a body. We don't know whether there's really a murderer, but is there some evidence that there was a murder versus is the confession itself trustworthy? Can we look at something else to determine its trustworthiness?
Precisely. And look at what Judge Briggs did in Trujillo. In Trujillo, Judge Briggs, it's conspiracy to commit robbery. He talked about there's evidence of the trustworthiness of the statement. There was a robbery. Trujillo didn't go in. He stayed in the car, but he described the person who went in accurately. He described a gun. There was a gun. It's the kind of gun he described. They found it.
Now, the problem, though, is that we have robbery, we have a gun, we have a murder. In a case like this, we have a child victim who can't corroborate, and that kind of situation arises, unfortunately, all the time. So, what would the judge look for this confession plus, whether it's trustworthiness or corpus delicti?
And that was the argument in the Washington case that I cited, State v. Ray, which is on page 17 of my brief. And in that case, the child was 3. And so we had this issue that you've raised. Is there independent evidence that a crime was committed? And in People v. Ray, the Washington court walked through that and said, yes, there is independent evidence in these cases. Cited a lot of cases talking about that. In my brief, I cited Fazy, our Supreme Court case, Fazy. And in Fazy, that's where the Supreme Court, you'll recall, made the evidentiary ruling regarding expert testimony. I think it was a PTSD case, and the child was 6 in that case. And so what the Washington court has said and what our court has done in Fazy and other cases, as you all know, is that in these cases, which are troubling, to be sure, they're troubling, but in these cases, our courts have made evidentiary accommodations and concessions on firm ground, on valid grounds. Our courts have made those concessions and those accommodations to allow the prosecution to prove the commission of that offense in various ways, be it experts, be it behavior changes, be it medical evidence, in many, many ways. And so down through the years, to accommodate that interest, which tugs at us all, our courts have made those accommodations. It can be done. It is done. It's done every day in the trial courts in this state, and it's approved all the way up to this chamber. And so, yes, the cases are of the very young children, I agree, are a little different. I agree. It tugs at me, too. But there are ways, and our courts have found that there are ways. And these are not inchoate crimes like Trujillo or like Smith. Smith was in that. That's how the whole federal trustworthiness corroboration rule came to be, because of these federal inchoate crimes where you would not expect there to be tangible evidence of a corpus delicti. No one, at least our courts, have not held that these troubling cases or those kind of cases in which there would be no tangible proof of a corpus delicti falling back on the trustworthiness or corroboration rule. And I think it is wise that the court has not done so, because the evidentiary accommodations and concessions that the court has made to allow the prosecution to prove these cases, even the difficult ones.
Mr. Lewis, I'm sorry again. I think what you're saying makes some sense. Essentially, though, upon this kind of a motion, you'd have to have a mini trial, essentially, to determine whether or not the case should even go forward. Go ahead.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay.
There's a couple ways to look at that. It's probably an issue that a defense lawyer is going to raise early and often, sort of like voting. on the other hand, it's probably better suited for a motion at halftime, probably. There was a very good trial counsel in this case, a very scholarly motion that was filed. It was presented to the court early. What really happened in this case, as you can see from the record, is in the hearing, in the pretrial hearing, the prosecution promised some things that they didn't deliver. I don't see any issue, and I think it was good practice for Mr. O'Malley to raise it pre-trial. It was an obvious issue. It was screaming at everyone. For the trial judge, it's probably better from the trial judge's perspective to have it at halftime, where they can really see what the prosecution has really brought to the table and what's really been done. But I think, as the cases have held, you can raise it anywhere, because it truly is a sufficiency of the evidence argument.
And so before you move on, can you just follow up with an application, I guess, in this case? I mean, I take it your position is, regardless if we call it the pure corpus delicti or trustworthiness, the outcome is the same. Correct, there is insufficient evidence here.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if you could help me or just respond directly to the people's argument that they do have some insufficient or some corroboration. Maybe that's not the right word, but the multiple, stating it to multiple people, the fact that there was a Highlands Ranch rec center, the fact that there was a bench there, you know, I mean, they come through a list of items, and I'm wondering if you could just address those specifically.
I can, and I think that if this court and the Court of Appeals down through the years have talked about opportunity evidence, and that's just opportunity evidence. And I think the Court of Appeals appropriately said that the fact that Mr. LaRosa could describe a facility that he had been to is really of no help to the court. The actions
even under the trustworthiness version of this?
Yeah, that's interesting. Under the trustworthiness standard, the independent evidence has to be even stronger, the cases say, than under the true corpus delicti doctrine. So even if there were a trustworthiness standard, the independent evidence in this case doesn't meet that standard. The cases suggest that under the corroboration rule or the trustworthiness standard, there has to be substantial evidence, independent evidence, to support the trustworthiness of the statement. Ironically, in some way, it seems that we're relaxing this rule, but in some ways it even makes the standard of independent evidence proof even higher, according to the cases. That's what they suggest. In our case, the Court of Appeals didn't really go there because they were operating under Rankin in the corpus delicti rule. But clearly, if they didn't find sufficient evidence under Quinn and other cases, they're not going to find it under the trustworthiness rule.
So there really is no difference on the facts of this case between those two, the pure rule and the trustworthiness rule?
I don't think so. I think the facts are the facts. And I think that even if the court were operating under the trustworthiness rule, whatever that is, the facts would be the same. The trustworthiness rule still requires independent evidence to show the trustworthiness of the statement. It's not a bootstrap of the statement. So I think even under that analysis, the facts of our case come out the same.
But isn't the focus different? Under corpus delicti, we're concerned about whether or not a crime took place. Under the trustworthiness theory, we're concerned about the statement and its trustworthiness. And under substantial evidence, we're concerned about whether the evidence is sufficient to meet the elements which have been charged.
True.
So the judge would really have three kind of different questions in her mind. And trustworthiness would require a different kind of evidence than corpus delicti. Corpus delicti would require something to show that there was this crime. Trustworthiness is just what kind of a person he was, how many people he told. You're disagreeing with me, and I'm interested in why, please.
There are two concepts.
Okay.
One is the statement trustworthy because it wasn't coerced and nobody threatened? We're already beyond
that. We're way past that.
We're past that on John Kerry's. The other is it trustworthy? And you said it earlier. These things merge and they blend and they become gray. Is it the real test under the trustworthiness rule still whether or not a crime has been committed? Isn't it trustworthy because the defendant is probably telling the truth? And it probably really happened.
Well, if if there's no evidence of a crime, we have this three-year-old child, there's no way we can really prove. There's no physical trauma, etc. There's nothing which would be outside of this confession. We still might, the confession might be trustworthy for other reasons, for reasons intrinsic to the defendant, such as we have here. He told a lot, he told his priest, and those kinds of things. I really want you to disagree with me, so tell me why you are, please.
No, I'm following you. I really am. Right. And I see the logic in what you're saying. I think the court goes down a rocky road if it makes those case-specific concessions.
So, Lewis?
Yes,
the difference that you're talking about with Justice Rice, I think the point here is that the corroboration, at least arguably, could come from the multiple confessions and so forth that Justice Rice just made. Whereas in the United States Supreme Court case, the trustworthiness has to come by corroboration from extrinsic evidence. That's your argument, really.
It's precisely.
I haven't read all the cases, but I'm sure there's a case that talks about the trustworthiness and makes the distinction that Justice Rice is trying to make, the difference between the existence of a crime and whether or not the confession itself is trustworthy.
And there are. Okay. And there are circuit cases, as you
So it's not quite so circular, I guess, as you're suggesting.
It's two different concepts, actually.
Right.
And the concept that you're talking about could properly be characterized as a minority one, in which the courts are not really looking outside the statement. Most of the trustworthiness cases come over to this other concept, but you're right, obviously. There are circuit court cases, and more than one, which go to this concept of simply staying within the four corners, if you will, of the statement. That's a rocky road.
Yeah, I mean, it's very hard to prove trustworthiness if you had nothing outside of the statement itself. You'd have a psychiatrist coming in and testifying about mental state and whatnot. Right. But I want to make sure I understand precisely your position. Your position is nothing but corpus delicti, right?
In some ways, I think Mr. LaRosa doesn't have doesn't have a horse in that race, because I think this is done as to him. It's conceded that the evidence was insufficient. And yet I think, as I said in my briefs, that corpus delicti is a good idea, because it does prevent unreliable statements from resulting in a conviction. There's such powerful evidence. I think it is a minimal inconvenience to the court. I think it is a minimal inconvenience to the prosecution. And let's face it, I say respectfully, the policy argument from the prosecution standpoint is that it would make it easier to prove some of these cases if we don't have to prove independent evidence, because it's difficult in some of these cases, I think. But I respectfully suggest that...
I don't see the incentive on the prosecution not to bring in whatever evidence there may be. You know, you got to convince a jury, and jurors can be skeptical. But it seems to me there's a huge community policy price to pay for this position, you know, in terms of unprosecutable crimes on those who are least able to defend themselves.
A very small number of crimes. Even one is too many, I agree. They're very, very small number of crimes, and the corpus delicti rule has not been relaxed. It wasn't relaxed in Rankin. It wasn't relaxed in Robson, where the court referred to the child as an infant. To be sure, there are those cases, very few, and I suggest that as a policy issue, the corpus delicti rule is a small price to pay for that kind of judicial reliability in convictions. And the other thing I can say about those cases, even though we all shrink from them, they're life sentences. They're serious, serious cases with serious consequences, and this protection is a small price to pay. Please keep it in place.
Thank you. Mr. Keller?
Address Justice Hyde and Rice's questions about overlap between trustworthiness and corpus delicti. Corpus delicti just looks at whether somebody committed the crime. Here it would have been an injury to the child, or possibly somebody looking off from the side and seeing the act happening but not knowing who. Trustworthiness could be supported by either of those things, but it also looks at the manner of the defendant giving the statement. here with the evidence, substantial evidence, we think that can meet, easily meet the trustworthiness is we had the 911 operator, we had this deputy say they'd had testimony about the manner, the way the defendant had made his statements. He did not, was not acting crazy or deranged. He was giving it in a normal conversational manner. He gave valid reasons for wanting to confess. And then that's enough to go to the jury. And then the actual issue of whether the defendant gave it or not, or what caused him to confess, that was actually presented to the jury in this case. Defendant testified, his wife testified, and his mother testified. They heard that testimony, which I point out, it was not backed by anybody saying that some level of stress can cause you to confess to a crime like this, let alone that the defendant was suffering from some sort of stress that would meet this high level. And I think I suggested pretty strongly in our brief that that's not a really strong basis, but the jury heard this evidence and decided as a factual issue, all 12 members of the jury, that it did not raise a reasonable doubt concerning the prosecution's case that this was a valid confession. I think that should be enough for this court to change the rule and follow this trustworthy, this intermediate trustworthiness rule. And again, we're still holding to our position that the trustworthiness rule is really out of date as the Sixth Circuit and D.C. Court of Appeals.
The trustworthiness, though, does provide the most maximum flexibility of the rules which we've been talking about today, because it looks not only to the crime, but it also looks to the intrinsic worth of the confession.
Well, it's a super flexible approach.
Sure, and it's broader than just the pure substantial elements or substantial evidence, which boils down to substantial, did you prove the elements, sort of a test.
I'm
wondering, in light of that, why you're so dismissive of it? The trustworthy test.
I think it's a better rule. It's a better rule than corpus delicti. I think the substantial. So many times that I can't remember anymore. Substantial evidence test better meets the role of letting juries make this determination. Corpus delicti, or even the trustworthiness test itself, there's an element to that of trial courts or appellate courts making credibility determinations. Our view is that credibility determinations are something for juries to make on the basis of evidence presented to it. And I think that was done in this case, and I think this court should reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the trial court's judgment in this case. Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Actually, I'm sorry. Chief, if I may ask a question before you step away from the podium. In your view, if we were to, first of all, it would require an abandonment of the corpus delicti rule if we were to move in any direction here.
Correct.
It's also your view that under the trustworthiness rule, if we were to move in that direction, that the outcome here would be different because there was sufficient evidence to, independent evidence to corroborate the trustworthiness of the confession in this case. Is it your view then, could you then respond to Mr. Lewis's statement from an ex post facto standpoint, why that change in the law ought to apply in this case?
Well, I think on appeal, what we're doing is we're talking about what are the proper standards for reviewing sufficiency claims in this kind of context. If the defendant had been acquitted or the trial court had rejected the case down below on the basis of corpus delicti, I think we might have a pretty hard time getting that. Although, well, I guess that could be the source, but determination of what rules to apply in a case, I don't think the following of a rule, even for 300 years, sort of puts the law into some sort of stuck in amber like a fly from thousands of years ago. The question is this the proper rule to apply? And under, Rogers versus Tennessee, U.S. Supreme Court says pretty clearly that the termination of rules like this does not violate ex post facto. The termination of which is the proper rule to address this question is something that can be addressed here.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Mr. Lewis, since that question injected a new issue, which you did address in your brief, but do you want to say anything in about a minute and a half?
The Rogers issue, should you change the law in this case, and the Dreesland issue, which is the Colorado case, This was well entrenched law. This was not some evidentiary rule. This is not the year and a day rule, which had never been relied upon by the Tennessee court in any decision. I mean, it was in name only. This is a rule that our Supreme Court has written on for many years, and I suggest that the court could not find under the Dreeselin rule and the Rogers rule that Mr. LaRosa could have reasonably anticipated, so that there's fair notice under due process, that he could have reasonably anticipated that the law would be changed and applied to him. There are too many Supreme Court cases. There are too many Court of Appeals cases. And so I think under those rules, and I think it is a due process rule rather than a pure ex post facto rule, although Mockley, that I cited, the Utah court on page 19, dealt with it as an ex post facto issue because it's tantamount. It's analogous to almost a legislative enactment. It's not, but it's analogous to it because it is truly a substantive point of law in our jurisprudence. So under those standards, if the court changes the law, I suggest that due process would not allow that to be applied retroactively.
Thank you. Does anybody else have any other questions? I want to thank both attorneys for their arguments and your briefs. The case will be decided on the briefs, and we'll take